This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And on this week's show, we delve a little more into ancient mysteries. We're going to be talking with Carl Lehrberger about his new book, Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. And are you with us there, Carl?
I am, and good evening, Zariah, and greetings to Where Did the Road Go radio listeners.
And this is your only book, right?
Only book yet.
Okay. So what? How did you get into all this stuff?
Well, people can find a little more about how I got into it and about the book at my newhistoryofamerica.com website at www.newhistoryofamerica.com. But I've been an explorer most of my life and have spent time in South America and Central America beginning very early. But it was 1986 when I read Barry Fell's America BC that really excited me. And I was living in New England at that time. And Dr. Fell, who is was a professor at Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology, became an expert in the old world peoples in America. And by using a skill that he developed in reading ancient inscriptions called epigraphy, he generated a tremendous amount of interest among people like myself, where he, I thought, demonstrated that the Celts and many other old world peoples had made it to the New World long before Columbus. And after reading that book, which was published in 1976, so I'm Johnny-come-lately, you could say, I began to explore some of the sites that Dr. Fell described in the book that were to be found in New England, including areas of Vermont, New Hampshire, and even New York, your state. Mm-hmm. And that got me into it and set out a 25-year quest that resulted in writing and publishing Secrets of Ancient America.
And how long did it take you to write this book?
Oh, I have about 20 to 25 years of field research in it, but it took me 3 to 4 years to pen. I found so many amazing things that my head was about to pop, and I thought I just had to get it out. Some of the evidence that I did find of old world travelers in the New World. And each chapter really documents one researcher that I focused on, and in most cases I knew the researchers and spent time with them and did my very best to learn what they had to teach and to write up their research as part of a collective body of work that describes much of the diffusionist versus isolationist debate that we still have today that's kept us from knowing what our history is in America.
And that's amazing to me, that the fact that there is such a wealth of evidence, and we don't need 2 tons of evidence to prove that people from the other side of the world were in this country before Columbus, but we have it and it's still ignored.
It's really shocking. And, you know, I think that many Americans, especially those that listen to shows, you know, like yours, Soraya, you know, are aware that we've been lied to about our history. But what I found in the book is that there is really a significant body of work and evidence that there were many old world peoples that visited America long before Columbus, including the Celts, including the Romans, including the Hebrews, and including people from India and Indus Valley civilization. And what became obvious in studying the work of others and mentors is that the serious claims of old world contact have been ignored by the archaeological community. And at the conclusion of the book, I write that we've been lied to about our history and that the historical record has been completely expunged. And what makes it worse is those who challenge the status quo have been discredited. People like Barry Fell and anthropologist Gunnar Thompson, who wrote America Discovery, have presented really significant evidence in, that old world peoples were here, but have never been recognized by the archaeological or the academic community.
And why is that? Why are they so against recognizing any kind of pre-Columbus contact?
Boy, that's a good question, and it's and you know, I think that the first is that the whole story of Columbus is a real mythology, and it supports a vision of America that is white. Whites discovered America and that brought civilization, you know, to the New World. But when one looks at the historical record, there was a civilization here of the Native Americans, and that what the whites bought was genocide and slavery. And I think that Columbus was the vanguard of that, and the mythology of American exceptionalism is somewhat rooted in the mythology of Columbus. So those who dare to suggest that Columbus was last, not first, in discovering America really have to be discredited, or the whole a story of white supremacy and American exceptionalism supporting the American genocide becomes to unravel. And I think that those in academia that have rested their careers on a lie, the last thing they want to do is admit that they were wrong. And I think that is in part the reason why we have a continuation of a lie of who discovered America.
And one of the myths that you talk about in this book is that at the time, most people did not believe the world was flat.
That's correct, and you know, the knowledge that the world was round really goes back, you know, to the Greeks. The Chinese drew around maps, and it's just a really small part of history, American history, that they claim the world was flat. You know, to put one religious group ahead of another. But what the book pointed out to me in the research that I uncovered is that at the time of Columbus, you know, there were a history here of America that far exceeded the civilization that Columbus brought to the Americas. That includes not only in the sciences such as astronomy and astrology, but also in navigation and in mineralogy. So there was a tremendous emergence of Europe out of the Dark Ages. But meanwhile, the rest of the world, including India and the New World, you know, had advanced civilizations in many ways superior to the European culture. What Europe did bring after, you know, years of conquest and war in the old world is a tyrannical ability to muster technology for war and for conquering. And one of the conclusions of the early part of the book is that Columbus knew precisely where he was going based on earlier maps from the Arabs and from the Vikings, and that it was a mission to seek out riches and gold. And that's part of the lie that has been disguised, and I write about that. And those that really hold the white vision of America that as opposed to a multicultural society of America, you know, are going to continue to challenge this new history of America, and instead want to hang on to the old history that believes that Columbus did discover America, and that the Americas were inhabited by savages instead of having a continuity of civilizations over here that had incredible architecture, art, culture, and science.
Now, we all know the official story of how Columbus discovered America, but from what you've written, it sounds like things were okay the first time he came over. It wasn't an immediate genocide. But when he came back, can you get into a little of what happened?
Well, it's a very dark and sad period for the America and the Native Americans. As I said, it was really a mission to seek out gold and riches, and when he did find in the Caribbean natives wearing little bits of gold that they had been able to collect, he essentially enslaved them, the Caribs, and demanded that each adult deliver a thimble of gold a week. And if they weren't able to provide the gold, they were to lose their hands. And the most horrible crimes is described by the Spanish writers themselves that transpired. And of course, part of the genocide was a physical genocide, but as we all know, with the European germs and viruses, after Columbus had been in the Caribbean for 20 to 25 years, after 25 years, the civilization had been pretty much wiped out by disease. So Columbus was really the first of a line of European conquerors and conquistadors, followed by Cortez and Pizarro that really claimed 90% of Native Americans within 50 years.
Now, how come the diseases didn't come with earlier explorers? Why did they come with these Europeans? Was it just that they were more apt to have these diseases than some of the earlier visitors?
Well, that's a good question, and I'll be honest and say that we don't know. I think one thing we can say is that the levels of settlers were not quite as great, although the Celts did achieve a significant landing in New England, and they made their way through the river systems all the way into Colorado and Oklahoma. I think that it was a issue of numbers, and the fact is we just don't know what results the contact in those days had. But it's a good question and another reason for really studying a new history of America. If the archaeologists and the anthropologists don't believe that Romans, Celts, Mediterranean peoples were here, how could we even possibly ask that question? So it's a great jumping off point to ask, you know, the question, why aren't the academics, the archaeo-priesthood, looking at questions like this, and not only questions of disease, but what happened to some of these explorers that made it over here?
Yeah, and you say in the book that it's likely that they either died or were assimilated into the native cultures.
Or returned, you know, with their gold and silver and whatever else they came over here for. So especially with civilizations coming over the Pacific, like from India, we had a constant contacts that went on for hundreds of years at a time, and we had very well organized mining expeditions and navigations inland into Nevada and California. And these very well organized mining expeditions were regular occurrences, probably based on astronomical and astrological cycles, as well as seasonal cycles, so that they could use the currents and the trade winds. So there was not only do we see warfare between the natives and some of the new colonists, as described it in a series of lead crosses that had been found near Tucson, Arizona, describing a colony called Calalus that existed in Arizona from about 600 to 900 AD. And the chronicler of that community describes how at the end the Native Americans, or the Toltecs as they were described on these lead crosses, pretty much wiped out the community of Calalus. And there are other references, including in the book by Gene Matlock, India Once Ruled America, of how often harsh the conditions were for these colonists. There's other evidence that many of these groups were integrated into Native Americans, or if not the actual groups themselves, as demonstrated through DNA of some Native groups, including some of the Cherokee tribes. We do find in some Native American groups words from Old World languages that are still in use today, and also many of the stories that Native Americans of specific tribes tell. It's a good point in the conversation to say that the 99.9% of the petroglyphs in North America are from Native Americans or from the ancestors of the Native Americans. And in the book Secrets of Ancient America, I rely very heavily on about 15 or 16 sites, petroglyph sites, that are not Native American sites, that they have inscriptions or writing from the Celts in particular, but we also find Roman writing and Phoenician writing in the Americas. But the point is that this evidence of Old World travelers, especially the inscriptions, I don't want to leave the impression with the audience that some or most of the petroglyphs are Old World. In fact, it's a very, very, very small group of several dozen that really make the case that the Old World peoples were here. But the point is that is evidence. These writing in stones, some of them have dates on it, including the Kensington runestone from Minnesota that has a date as it tells the story of these Icelanders coming to America. So when the archaeopriest and the archaeologists say there is no evidence that Old World peoples from both the Trans-Pacific and Transatlantic were not here, it's simply a lie. There is an abundance of evidence, and the best evidence that I found were these inscriptions written in stone found throughout America.
So the argument comes down to the diffusionism, which is as you know, that these people could actually navigate the world, versus the isolationist argument that the Americas were completely separate from the rest of the world until Columbus got here. But the diffusionism argument is, as you put it, it's almost religious in the way that they approach it. Like, it's just, you can't challenge it, you can't argue with it. They'll blackball you, they'll do whatever they can. And you talk about the Smithsonian playing a part in this.
Well, you know, I set out to write a book because many of my mentors, including Barry Fell, Bill McGlone, Phil Leonard, Gunnar Thompson, Warren Dexter, Ida Jane Gallagher, Gene Matlock, Carl Johansson, many, many diffusionist scholars have written about certain aspects of diffusionism. That is, that culture comes from the outside as opposed to independent learning, many of the isolationists in academia believe. And perhaps with the exception of David H. Kellady from the University of Calgary, most diffusionists aren't archaeologists. And in the case of Kelly, he was tolerated by the academic community because he was an academic himself and was a very famous Mayanist who was instrumental in cracking some of the Mayan code. So the attitude about David Kelly was, oh, you know, that was just David Kelly going way off in La La Land about diffusionism. You know, we tolerate him because of he's an academic. So there is just a tremendous history of dozens and dozens of diffusionist writers, but none of us have broken through the paradigm. And you mentioned the Smithsonian, and let's also talk about National Geographic. In five chapters of the book, I document in great detail the exploits and the travels of Celtic travelers in New England, in West Virginia, and in Colorado, as well as sites in Oklahoma and Kansas. And it's not just my research, but it's the research of many thorough researchers that have documented this. And to this day, I've never seen a article or anything to do with Celts in America in National Geographic or the Smithsonian. And being up there in New York, where you are, is one of the most accessible sites that we have in America demonstrating a Celtic presence in America, and that is America's Stonehenge in southern New Hampshire, right near the border with Massachusetts. And this is a massive site that has stone structures where apparently they live, but most importantly, the site is an archaeoastronomical site where they had large monoliths to cast shadows on the specific days of the year of the equinoxes and the cross quarter days. Those are those special days between equinox and solstice that the ancient Celts marked. And one can go to America's Stonehenge and go to the center of the site and look out down below and see where these ancient monolithic stones were set up so that one could line up to the sun. So it's not like Scientific America or National Geographic or the Smithsonian, you know, would be stepping out so far because there's such a significant body of published research and artifacts documenting the Celts. And by artifacts, I mean stone inscriptions written in Celtic languages here in America, dozens of them. So none of us have broken through the paradigm, the archaeo-priesthood dogma that not only we find in the major publications of the day, but most importantly, we find these archaeo-priests as the gatekeepers to universities. And the experience that Gunnar Thompson, who wrote America Discovery, had is just a case in point where even though Dr. Thompson was able to document dozens and dozens of symbols from India and to a lesser extent China, but from Asia in Mesoamerica, he was never able to get much credentials or tenure, and he was they wouldn't even allow him to publish his dissertation because it did document this diffusionist theme. So, you know, until we see some kind of openness on the part of the major publications of our day, like National Geographic and the Smithsonian, and until we get students and graduate students insisting that the old archaeopriest open up the curriculum to look at some of these fascinating evidence of old world travelers in the new world and the evidence that they left behind, most Americans are going to remain in the dark.
Now, it seems like these institutions will sort of accept that maybe the Vikings made it here. And I there was an article just recently published about them finding a Norse village dating from the 9th or 10th century along the Hudson River. Are you familiar with that?
The most of the evidence of the, you mean the upper Hudson River, and most of the evidence really is not so much in North America, but in places like islands in between. However, you're absolutely correct. They will, the archaeopriest and the archaeological community will acknowledge that perhaps Eric the Red and some of the Vikings were here. But it continues to ignore the tremendous amount of evidence that we have. And, you know, some of that evidence of colonies in the upper New York and in southern Canada has been uncovered and written about by perhaps the most famous diffusionist of his day, Thor Heyerdahl. Now, Thor Heyerdahl is a name many people are familiar with. He sailed the Kon-Tiki and really proved that you could make these large, long voyages across the oceans to America. But as famous and as charismatic as Thor Heyerdahl was, his most important book on diffusionism, which in English was translated to be No Borders, was never translated out of his native Norwegian. And in his book, along with his co-author Par Lillestrøm, Heyerdahl went to the Vatican and he documented from the tax records that there was a lively group of colonies in Upper New York and in Canada, and it's documented because of the tax records. So he wrote the book, which included some of this evidence from the Vatican, as well as other evidence that he and his geographer co-author wrote about. But the book No Borders was never translated out of Norwegian, and very, very few people have ever heard about it. So this somewhat conspiracy against the diffusionists even trapped Thor Heyerdahl, as famous as he was.
And he kind of went to prove what I first heard David Hatcher Childress say, that the oceans are highways, not obstacles.
And that is such a great point. And it's just incredible that we think of the ancients as kind of primitives, when in fact their shipbuilding capabilities and their navigational skills were far superior to the Spanish in 1492. The ships carried not dozens of people, but hundreds of people. They were massive, and they were very well adorned. Ships coming from India to America were adorned with gold and silver, and were really set for expeditions. So Childress puts it very well. They were the highways and the byways of the ancient world. And to this day, when I do talk about the book, the very first question that a astounded person might ask is, well, how could they have possibly got here? And it's just so far out of our modern thinking because of our educational or disinformation that we've received, that we don't understand that for the peoples of India, as well as the Phoenicians and the Celtic, they had far superior mariner skills than the Europeans in 1492.
It also, I think, has something to do with that sort of social evolution sort of view, where whatever we have now is the most advanced we could possibly have. And since that's our culture in 1492, that's the most advanced that could have existed, because who could be more advanced than us?
Well, throughout the book, and especially at the end, I referred to the Planet of the Apes movie, because I found that to be such a great analogy to what I see going on with the archaeopriesthood. And for those in our audience who remember the original Planet of the Apes movie, it ends with Zarius, who was the head of the ape school of archaeology, school of sciences, destroying the evidence of a human village because the chimpanzee Cornelius, the young archaeologist, had discovered that the ape culture had come from a previous society of humans. So this, as the movie ends, this village was burned, the evidence was burned, And I think that we can make a pretty good case that much of the evidence of the old world peoples in America has been covered up in that kind of analogy.
All right. So Barry Fell was, you know, one of the things that got you started onto this. You want to tell us a little bit about him and what he did?
Well, Barry Fell, you know, is nobody wants to be associated with Barry Fell, because the truth of the matter is that even though he inspired many people and he really, I think, started a new history of the study of a new history of America, beginning, you know, in the later part of the 20th century, we have to acknowledge that Barry Fell made some pretty significant mistakes. He was a pioneer in that he, as a microbiologist, he learned epigraphy, which is the study of ancient writing systems, and set about a career of looking at inscriptions from all over the world, but particularly ancient inscriptions in America, and doing his best to interpret them. He founded a society that looked at epigraphy, the Aesop Epigraphy Society of occasional publications that at its time was the most famous diffusionist journal. And he published three major books as well as literally hundreds of journal articles. And in one sense, he was a pioneer in that he opened the door for many of us researchers and documented a history of America that most people weren't aware of. On the other hand, his scientific methods were lacking in many cases. He would take people's drawings of inscriptions or photographs, and not having visited the sites, would often try to do an interpretations that other diffusionist scholars found to be incorrect. And so because of this, he left himself very vulnerable to critiques from the academic community. And I think what happened with Dr. Fell is that the academics, in spite of his great work and original research, threw the baby out with the bathwater, because he did make some serious mistakes, and because he did often not visit these sites and only show part of the drawings done by others, he was discredited. So many of the modern diffusionists have to be very careful that we want to acknowledge that Barry Fell was really the pathfinder that got many of us interested in looking into a new history, and that Barry Fell documented many, many sites that have proven to be correct in terms of his interpretation, particularly with some of the Celtic writings. But we also have to acknowledge that Barry did make mistakes, and it has made it much more difficult for diffusionist scholars to emerge, you know, from the background, because the ploy of the archaeopriesthood and the academians is to label you as somebody who believes like Barry Fell, which has a very you know, negative name in academia. And if one were to go and take a look at you know, some of the Wikipedia articles, for example, they're very critical of Dr. Fell, and I would have to say, in some cases, rightly so. But having said that, Dr. Fell blazed a pathway that dozens and dozens of authors and diffusionists have taken off and taken to the next level. And a great example of that is my mentors, Phil Leonard and Bill McGlone, worked with Barry Fell for years, but for this very reason of his scientific methods broke with him. But McGlone and Leonard spent a career looking at the Celts in some of the Celtic sites in Colorado, Oklahoma, and Kansas, and taking some of Barry Fell's interpretations of those inscriptions to the next level. And they discovered many more inscriptions out here in the West, as well as archaeoastronomy sites where you have light and shadow play on the equinox, for example, that tell a story. Archaeoastronomy is a language of the ancients that's hardly recognized by the archaeological community. But Leonard and McGlone studied archaeoastronomy, and looking at the Celtic inscriptions, they were able to determine that these inscriptions in Colorado, Oklahoma, and Kansas were talking about celestial days of the year, like the equinox. For example, one of the inscriptions that McGlone and Leonard interpreted with Fell's help was that the sun strikes here on the day of Bel. This is a Celtic inscription found in a cave in southern Colorado that's accompanied by a light and shadow show on the equinox, where light streams into a narrow opening of a cave and strikes the inscription precisely where it says strikes here. That's where the sun strikes on the day of the equinox, referred to in the inscription as the day of Bel, B-E-L, the well-known god that we even, sun god that we even see documented in the Bible. So we here have two colleagues and students of Barry Fell that both acknowledge his great work, but also had severe reservations about his methods, went off on their own, and made incredible discoveries. But because they have an association with Barry Fell at some point, they were discredited, and to this day, even though their work remains the most significant documentation of the Celtic presence in America, nobody has ever heard of the name Phil Leonard or of Bill McGlone or read any of their books. Hopefully the attention that I gave them in Secrets of Ancient America in three chapters will help all of us understand that a tremendous amount of research and knowledge exists documenting and proving that the Celts, as well as other people, were here, if we can get the word out.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 1 minute with Carl Lehrberger.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and not necessarily those of WVBR or its management. Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we're talking with Carl Lehrberger about his book, Secrets of Ancient America. And this is a thick volume. This is almost 400 pages. It's a big book. You have a lot of pictures, and the information is just dense in this volume. It's not something you just flip through. You have packed so much solid information in here, and you keep it very, very grounded. You don't go off into idle speculations. You're looking for stuff you can actually nail down, and that is a really refreshing take on this.
Well, thank you, Zurai. I really appreciate that, because one of the most important things that I tried to do in the book is take the high road as far as presenting evidence that could be documented. And there's a lot of different roads to go down in the new history. And when push comes to shove, in many cases, for example, giants in North America, as well as aliens in rock art, I was never able to come up with smoking guns. So I really stayed to the areas of archaeoastronomy, epigraphy, and the evidence that has been documented, as well as some of the discoveries that I've made, to do my best to make a credible and convincing case that we've been lied to about our history, that Columbus did not discover America, and that we have an incredible a multicultural tradition here in America of travelers and groups coming both across the Atlantic and across the Pacific to America, not only for gold and silver and riches in regular mining expeditions, but also to settle here. Many of the ancients came here escaping the politics and wars that took place throughout the world. Others, perhaps, were driven here by a climate and weather conditions and perhaps even comet disasters. So America, you know, as it is today, was in those days a refuge. The point of the book is really to expose that we've been lied to, and that to inspire others to look at the evidence and to take the studies to the next level in the universities and in the media, and do our very best to reconstruct a new history of America.
And I do appreciate the fact that more and more areas are that Columbus Day is coming under fire. You know, there's a movement to change it to Native American or, you know, day, or just a day to celebrate the Native peoples here rather than Columbus.
And that's just a theme that's catching on in some cities and some states, and I think it will continue to catch on. You know, one of my inspirations in writing Secrets of Ancient America is the work of Gunnar Thompson, who I previously mentioned, who wrote America Discovery, as well as several other books documenting Old World peoples in America. And Dr. Thompson makes a very convincing case and a very powerful case that we have a very a proud tradition here in America of a multicultural country. Multicultural history. And as we peel away the layers of our history, that's going to be borne out. So it's not just the Native Americans that we have to celebrate and want to celebrate instead of the white conqueror Columbus, but it's also all the other groups that made it here and have been integrated into the American culture. So I think one reason why the archaeopriesthood and the academics have been so slow to respond to the evidence is that if they take away the Columbus myth, you know, what's left? And I think it's that what's left piece that is so frightening to the status quo.
And the problem, too, is not just from that side, but from the Native American side, too, at times, because you tell a story how you asked one Native American what he thought of some of these ideas, and he was offended that you would suggest that they didn't develop this culture entirely, you know, in an isolated environment.
It's a very, very sensitive topic with many Native Americans. I did document in the very early part of the book some of the esoteric traditions and the archaeoastronomical traditions of Native Americans and the wisdom of the Native Americans. And I really do my very best to show those traditions were very important. And without kind of putting any kind of spin on it, it's the Native American traditions stand on their own. However, in other instances, for example, a site in California that I devote two chapters to, making a connection with Indus Valley culture, at a particular site that the nearby Native American Paiute tribe claims was their ancestors, it was very clear that not only were the inscriptions and the petroglyphs not Native Americans, but that no one from the tribe had even been to the site in decades, and yet they became very offended with the idea that it was not their people or their ancestors that created that site. So it's a very sensitive issue, and really all of us have something new to learn with the new history of America. But I did my very best to both celebrate the wisdom of the Native Americans in the book, but point out that while we do have the migration from Asia across the Bering Straits and the land bridge down through the Americas, as has been documented. We also have other pathways across the oceans from the east and across the ocean from the west. And those travelers that came from Europe, from the Mediterranean, and those travelers that came from Asia and from Indus Valley had an impact on some of the ancestors to the Native Americans. I do my very best in the book not to talk about Native Americans as a whole, but to be very specific, especially relating to some of the likely contact that these Old World travelers had with specific groups. Once we start talking in generalities about the Native Americans in contact with Old World peoples is when we really begin to lose the argument. But when we get into the specific groups or specific tribes and look at specific words or traditions, then we can maintain a semblance of credibility, because there are well-documented cases of Native Americans having contact, and this documentation includes DNA evidence. It includes some of the old world words finding their way into the Native American language, as well as looks and other traditions, specifically a group of Cherokees acknowledges that you know, they came from a Hebrew tradition, and they celebrate some of the same holidays that Hebrews celebrate, including the Sukkot holiday. So within some of the Native American tribes, we do find specific evidence. But it would be a terrible mistake to suggest that the Old World peoples left a lot of artwork all over, and that there's a significant amount of it, when in fact most of the petroglyphs are Native Americans or their ancestors. So, and it's the same with this kind of contact. We have to be very specific to tribes so we don't insult Native Americans. On the other hand, Native Americans need to be open to this new documentation and evidence, and the concept that there was contact and there was exchange of information and perhaps symbols, language, and ideas. A great example would be the symbol swastika, which is prevalent in many Native American tribes in the Pueblo regions of the West. Well, this is a Indus Valley symbol. It's a very ancient Indus Valley symbol, and there's very little doubt that this symbol, as well as dozens and dozens of other symbols that made it to the Americas, made it to North America and Central America, came from Asia or came from Indus Valley.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the Davenport tablets?
Well, you know, I did have a chapter in the book talking about the Midwest. And there's a tradition of many artifacts that had claimed to come out of the Midwest, specifically Michigan, but also other areas, including Iowa. And I set upon myself to go to the Midwest and talk to people, see some of the sites. And the Davenport stone is one of these so-called relics. It's in the Davenport, Iowa Museum. And Dr. Fell considered this Davenport tablet to be evidence of Old World peoples, and that the writing on it to be that of Old World peoples. And more recently, other diffusionist scholars have indicated that they agree but disagree on exactly if it's Egyptian or has other languages on it. What I discovered in looking at the Midwest is that there is a era called the Great Age of Hoaxes. And this took place really between around 1840 right up to the 19th century. There was just an incredible amount of forgeries, hoaxes, and one group of relics called the Michigan relics that some diffusionists really use as evidence that Egyptians had made it to America, because there really are thousands of these relics. I found to be most of them to be hoaxes, and it's sad to say that such a significant body of so-called evidence, thousands of tablets, most of them, if not all of them, are hoaxes. But that is what I came to the conclusion. Now, the Davenport stone that you ask about is not part of the Michigan relics. And while some diffusionist scholars claim that it is proof of old world travelers, I went to Davenport, Iowa, talked to the museum curator. It's one of the few relics that is on display, and I think it is on display because it's been discredited. So while there are significant evidence of old world travelers in the way of artifacts, including coins, many Roman coins, as well as other physical artifacts, including rock art, I didn't find the Michigan relics or the Davenport stones and tablets to be convincing. In fact, in case of the Michigan relics, as well as relics from a source called the Burroughs Cave, which is also famous, I believe most of, if not all, are hoaxes. And while I couldn't conclusively call the Davenport stones now on display hoaxes, I didn't find it was convincing evidence. And that's why I didn't, I spent one chapter on this, but it's why I focused five chapters on the Celts, because while they have been in the golden age of hoax, many different hoaxes and many different frauds perpetuated throughout the Americas, documenting, you know, the history, there is plenty of evidence that is credible and suggestive. Most importantly, the inscriptions left by the Celts in a Celtic language accompanied by archaeoastronomy. So I really focused on what I consider to be the smoking gun cases, proving that Columbus was not first, that he was last. And unfortunately, the Davenport stone and tablets, as well as the Michigan relics, are not smoking guns and in fact, are likely hoaxes.
Okay. Can you get into a little bit about the sites you looked at in connection to Ireland and the Celts?
Well, the Celts, I think we could almost rename New England as New Ireland. I believe that the Celts really had a colony here, beginning perhaps 2,500 years ago, and beginning with the mining of copper in Michigan. But they really had their beachhead in New England, as indicated at America's Stonehenge in New Hampshire, as well as many sites in Vermont and stone chambers in Western New York. They did mapping. We know that from the Curins they left in Celtic rods that has been documented. And traveling the tributaries, they found their way to the Mississippi, and from the Mississippi up the Arkansas. And from the Arkansas River, this is how they made their way into Colorado, Oklahoma, and Kansas, probably looking for routes to the Rocky Mountains. And in the areas of Colorado in particular, in Oklahoma, there's an abundance of inscriptions at, I would have to say, sacred sites that revolve around the equinox sunrise and revolve around the equinox sunset. And in some cases, the cross-quarter days. Beltane is the May Day holiday that is still celebrated to this day, as well as Lunasa, who named after the Celtic sun god Lu. And we find inscriptions to Lu and to Bel and to Grian, these are Celtic sun gods, in Colorado and Oklahoma, accompanied by incredible rock art and archaeoastronomy. I think that proves the Celts were here. And that's why I spent so much time on them. And not only do we have the physical evidence, but inscribed in the rock art and in the archaeoastronomy of the Celts is their cosmology. And I make the case in the book that some of the wisdom of the Mithraic religion that was a part of the cosmology of the ancients of Europe are found here in the New World, and most have been destroyed in Europe. So there's more information on the Mithraic religion in the Anubis caves in Oklahoma than you can find throughout Europe, even though it originated in Europe. And this is the importance of really the new history, not only for Americans, but for the world.
And why are the astronomical alignments proof of connection to these people when couldn't the Native Americans have come up with the same alignments and marked them as well?
And they did. But what makes them proof and makes them unique is they're accompanied by Celtic inscriptions that you could read so that it's the writing in the rock that couldn't have been faked in a Celtic language describing the astronomical event that occurs in the petroglyphs that are obviously not Native American petroglyphs. They are old world petroglyphs. So the proof is with the actual petroglyphs themselves, but most importantly with the accompanying Celtic inscriptions.
And how does the mainstream view dismiss these things? Or do they just not look at them?
They just don't look at them. A great example is that, one can go to the Four Corners area in the summer and see dozens and dozens of archaeologists and scores of graduate students studying Anasazi sites at Chaco Canyon and the whole Four Corner areas. But of these a dozen or so Celtic sites that you find, you will never see an archaeologist or a graduate student. They will stay away like flies. They will not go to these sites or look at them, so they completely ignore them. And it's ironic that somebody would be, so many archaeologists would be, digging and looking at Chaco Canyon when not too far away they could be looking at a Celtic site and maybe making a profound discovery. But it's the fear that they would be associated with diffusionism, with Barry Fell, and with the new history of America that keeps them from looking at these sites. So in most of my experience, I rarely see archaeologists at these old world sites.
All right. And we're going to stop there. We're going to do a second part to this because there's still a bunch of stuff I want to get to. And I don't want to rush through it and just try to squeeze it in because there's easily enough stuff here for another hour. So the book is Secrets of Ancient America, Archaeoastronomy, and the Legacy of the Phoenicians, Celts, and Other Forgotten Explorers. It's on Amazon. It's out through Inner Traditions. And your site is what?
www.newhistoryofamerica.com.
Okay. And what can people find there as well?
Well, they're going to see some information on the book, information on me, a little about my history, some of the work that I'm now doing in renewable energy and industrial hemp. I talk a little about that on the site, and those interested in learning about the renewable energy and industrial hemp work that I'm doing can visit me at purevisiontechnology.com. But I'd encourage people to go to newhistoryofamerica.com. If they want to purchase the book or find out a little more about it, I love to hear from the audience with questions as well as information that they have. Some of the best kept secrets are from the radio listeners out there. So please feel free to contact me via my site, newhistoryofamerica.com.
All right. And appropriately, I'm going to take you out with some Sax Mile, their track, which in Cherokee means my grandma, and it's pronounced Ujilisi. And we'll be back next week.
It's my restlessness that brings me here again. Each time I'll come out a little farther. Family's used to it by now, I suppose. And Grandma stopped her teasing. I was younger, with all that talk of the boogeyman. But who could blame a five-year-old with all the dried gourds and that creaky windmill? I guess it didn't do anything but make me want to come out and see for myself. It's just so looming. I've covered every square inch of this place at some point or another. Yeah, and over there behind that tree line is the Crawford's Pond. It's just that as that sun goes down behind those trees, it's like a change comes over everything. During harvest and into winter, each night I'll excuse myself from the table, throw on my jacket, and head out into the middle of this field. And with each step, I'll recall the things Grandma used to say to herself when she was working in the garden or maybe putting us kids to bed. Didn't make much sense at the time. She'd say, nine times will the cats play, and after that they'll have gone away. Bear the watcher and the sage. Dark as night when moon glow, come the smell of fall I know. Mind the specter and the sage. Used to sound creepy, but now I know what you meant. And maybe now she knows the mystery.